This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. There has been an ongoing conversation about mental health care in the U.S. After tragedies like the school shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary or Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, some political actors are quick to blame mental health issues. But despite these political talking points, public funding for mental health care has plummeted over the past few decades. And the history of mental health care in this country is fraught with mismanagement and abuse, often exacerbated by a lack of funding. Zeb Larson is a historian whose work has looked at the history of public mental health care in the U.S., and he joins me to talk about it. Zeb, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to start here. How long have there been public institutions in the United States that deal with mental health?
Well, that's a really interesting question there, Joy. When this country is created, formally, mental health care at a public level is extremely weak. In fact, it's mostly delivered through jails, you know, sort of informally providing care basically for people who live there long term. And it's private institutions that initially provide much of this service. In fact, it's Quaker institutions, first in Philadelphia, who I think opened one of the very first such hospitals in the United States. And these are what are referred to as asylums. They start to expand more as you get into the 1840s and 1850s, and that happens for a few reasons. Much of that is simply the growth of a large urban population. Cities, when the United States is first founded, they're pretty small, especially compared to anything you might find in Europe. But by the time you get to the 1840s and 1850s, you have these increasingly large cities, and these also, it's not yet quite urban exactly, but urbanizing population where it's not necessarily feasible to have a family care long-term for an ill individual. So they start to get moved into hospitals. And this is where you see the slow birth of a hospital system in the United States.
So when we move into these hospitals, what does care start to look like there? Because it's my understanding that for a lot of our history, mental illness itself was looked at very differently.
That's a really excellent point. And it is, I think you could say it's in many ways dramatically different from what we would expect today, for that matter. There's a great deal of focus in the 19th century, particularly, on trying to find permanent cures through what eventually they're going to call mental hygiene. That's a term that evolves later. But what it looks like in the 1840s and 1850s, as this sort of professionalizes, is this idea that you could rehabilitate people suffering from certain forms of mental illness by putting them in healthier surroundings. This almost invariably means taking them out of cities and moving them to the country, putting them to work at certain forms of rehabilitating work, so farming. This is actually why most mental hospitals in the United States, into the 1960s in many cases, actually had large working farms on them. Part of it was so that they could be self-sustaining and require, frankly, smaller budget appropriations from state governments. But it was also so, in many cases, they could put the people who worked there or lived there to some kind of work. And that's what ends up happening. So treatment is this kind of moral treatment that tries to restore people to what doctors perceive as sort of mental health. And that really sort of means making them productive. And then they can go back out and, in many cases, go back to what they had been previously doing before.
So when does mental health care, in the way that we view it today, when does that really start to emerge?
Well, there's a storied history to that one. I have to use that particular term for it. So this focus on sort of moral treatment and rehabilitation, it doesn't really work the way that doctors want it to. For one thing, a lot of forms of mental illness, they just don't respond to it that way. We know this now. So what happens over the course of the 19th century is that more and more people start to go into these hospitals. And these hospitals had always been founded with the assumption that people will get better, they will leave, we will take in new patients, cure them. But that's not really how it works for a lot of people. In many cases, they're chronically ill, especially with the kinds of treatments that are open to people in the 19th and early 20th centuries, so the hospital populations just swell. They keep getting bigger to the point that they far really outgrow what they had ever been intended to sort of house, and then at a certain point, doctors begin looking for new kinds of treatments to get away from the, what they call the warehousing of patients, and there are several treatments they arrive at that are really unsuccessful, but they embrace for a time because it seems doing something is better than doing nothing. And then beginning in the 1940s and early 1950s, we arrive at the development of actual antipsychotic drugs and antidepressants. And once those enter the picture, this is really transformative for these institutions because doctors are able to prescribe treatments that for many people dramatically improve their symptoms. Sometimes at the cost of certain side effects, sometimes only for periods of time, but compared to the tools that had been available to them previously, they're more effective by a whole order of magnitude.
Now, at this point, it seems like we enter a very interesting part of this history, and I'm interested to know, you know, alongside this treatment, this medical treatment for mental health, what were the political perspectives on these kinds of institutions, especially as we look at public health institutions?
You know, these institutions, in the early to mid-19th century, they were embraced a little bit more positively, to the point that actually there was a bill that went up in front of Congress in the 1850s that actually would have used government-owned land to actually fund a series of federal mental health asylums. It doesn't get passed. Franklin Pierce vetoes it, as I recall, and then that's sort of the end of the word on federal involvement. Then it falls to the states. And what it becomes for the states is an increasingly an expensive item that they have to allocate money to year after year and face rather sharp growth over, especially because the U.S. population ages a lot in this period compared to previous history. So politically, up to the 1930s, 1940s, you mostly see both parties doing anything that they can to try to get people out of hospitals. It's in the wake of World War II that you see Democrats especially, but in many cases Republicans, I'm thinking of some Western states here as well, that they look to the federal government as a new tool to drive mental health care. They see, and this is where you see Truman, for example, in 1946, pass the Federal Mental Health Act that creates the National Institute of Mental Health. You don't see immediately them stepping in and providing more money for the hospitals and the asylums, but there's this increasing role that the federal government comes to play, and that it continues until the mid-1960s, at which point you have President Kennedy create, this was actually, I think, the last law that he signs before he's assassinated in November of 1963, creating community mental health centers that will be administered by the federal government. So that's sort of, as quickly as I can, about a century's worth of political evolution on the topic.
Well, and as we move forward from the 1960s, I mean, as you mentioned, of course, we start to get drugs, antipsychotic drugs, that are able to treat people in a way that they don't have to be institutionalized. We also, of course, have, you know, earlier in the 20th century, the reports of real mistreatment at a lot of these institutions that cause a lot of, you know, public uproar against them. As we move into an era of that seems like the prevailing thought is deinstitutionalizing people, removing them from these places of care, how does that impact the funding for these kinds of mental health facilities?
Well, that's a great question. That actually, I mean, in some ways touches most closely on my own interest in this topic, is that in many cases, there were a lot of people, and really on both sides of the political aisle in this country, who thought that these new drugs, chlorpromazine, for example, that they would in some ways enable them to get rid of the hospital system entirely. There were sort of, and from the perspective of somebody living in 2020, they seem wildly optimistic. These projections that mental illness itself could entirely be cured because of these drugs. So in many cases, and this is true of some of the federal blue ribbon panels that are created in the 1950s to study this issue, there is this expectation that with enough money basically going to drug treatment, they'll just be able to close the hospitals almost entirely. And this is where you start to run up against some of the science of it, because while there are large numbers of people who respond very effectively to medications, they also run up against some people whose symptoms are more treatment resistant, who might require greater social safety net supports. So as you get into the 1960s and 1970s, you start to see more difficult discharges of people, people who require more support than is actually available to them in order to live effectively in the community, which in turn means that more resources get shifted away from hospitals to support those individuals, but then the hospitals themselves continue to suffer in quality. This is why you see throughout the 1960s and onward a number of scandals and revelations that come out about the way people are treated in many of the hospitals, patient neglect, for example.
Well, and the figure who you point out, especially in the federal government, is President Ronald Reagan and his 1981 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Bill. Can you unpack that a bit and how it impacted state community mental health centers?
So what Reagan does with the 1980 Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Bill, boy, that title is just a mouthful, isn't it? But what it does is it alters a funding scheme that had been relatively stable from Kennedy in 1963 to Reagan in 1980, in which the federal government provided X amount of money to these community mental health centers, and the expectation was that states would match the funds, and it was sort of a complicated funding scheme. And Reagan changes the funding structure very dramatically. First, there are dramatic cuts made in this period, and then the remainder of the money is, in many cases, allocated back to the states as block grants, meaning that they can do with those funds what they wish to do, which means in many cases they're not going to use it to use for mental health treatment, but they might use it to plug a different hole in the budget. So what you start to see then is this reduced level of federal commitment. And this, in turn, forces a number of hospitals to close. I do like to sort of put a cautionary note on describing too much of this to Reagan, because I think that in many ways what Reagan did in 1980 was sort of the culminating logic of this idea of deinstitutionalization, that we have more effective treatment mechanisms in the community, and in many cases, to be clear, they are more effective. So we can just kind of keep getting rid of the hospitals. That is sort of the end point of this logic. That is, incidentally, what he did as governor in California through the 1960s. So his actions as president, I don't think they're unique. Let me put it that way.
The idea being that even if Reagan hadn't been president, it's likely that another president would have passed something similar.
Indeed. And in many cases, a lot of the forces that are unleashed because of that, they're already sort of in play at the state level. That's where mental health care in this country is just so tricky, is that it's such a complicated interplay now between the federal government and the state government, because it's money coming from both sides. So it's very rarely just a monocausal thing.
Well, and to look at just the last few decades since that was passed, and since, you know, we've seen a lot of mental health facilities close in cities around the country. What has been the impact of defunding, not just at the federal level, but also at the state level, for these kinds of institutions?
Well, the institutions themselves, I mean, the hospitals have really become what they call forensic institutions. And by that, I mean, they really only cater to individuals who have committed a crime of some kind, or might be dangerous, and so they get sentenced there. I'm thinking about my home state, Oregon. In Oregon, the Oregon State Hospital is almost exclusively for people who have committed a crime but been found not guilty by reason of insanity. There are some individuals who get sent there to stabilize while awaiting trial, but that really is it. Oregon State Hospital overwhelmingly exists for that purpose. And the other state hospitals, Eastern Oregon State, for example, they've closed. So increasingly the focus is individuals will be treated only in communities at this sort of decentralized level. And how that, I think, plays out is then people are sort of at the whim of what the county and the state is willing to supply them, which means that even within a state, you get, I think it's safe to say, pretty wildly divergent outcomes in terms of access, in terms of how many people there are, in terms of the resources. And then, of course, whatever the economic situation is at the moment.
Well, and of course, now we're talking about people who frequently in conversations would be labeled as criminals. And so when we're talking about giving funds to people who can be labeled as criminals, it becomes a little bit more complicated on a political level.
It does, and this is also where it dovetails with, in many ways, mental illness has been recriminalized in this country. Remember, I said at the beginning of this that in the 1780s, 1790s, people were frequently treated in jails. We're back to that. The three largest mental health providers in the United States are Rikers Island, Los Angeles County Jail, and the Cook County Jail. This is overwhelmingly where people receive treatment. That's actually true at a smaller city level as well. So this is where, the mental health system just gets very complicated in this country.
Well, and to kind of sum it up, how would you describe where our mental health system is today, specifically our public mental health system, at a time when we're talking more and more about mental health for a variety of reasons, for often criminal reasons, but different socioeconomic outcomes that we'd like to change?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm a historian, so the closer I get to the present, the more uncomfortable I become in some ways. But I will say, what we've seen is, on the one hand, tremendous improvements in some ways. There is so much better understanding of mental health than there was 100 years ago. And increasingly, what they call the consumer perspective, which is to say the person who receives treatment, they are actually given a voice in a way that they would not have been 100 years ago. And I will just go to my grave maintaining that that is a tremendous historical justice that we've managed to write. However, what we've also exposed is that increasingly access to quality public mental health care in many ways depends on socioeconomic factors, which means there are a great many people who end up on the losing line of that. And that is something that we have not really rectified in this country. And to be honest, I think when people set out on deinstitutionalization, I'm not really sure that they were thinking through exactly how complicated this question was going to become.
Yeah. Well, Zeb, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you for having me.
Zeb Larson is a historian whose work has looked at the history of mental health care and treatment in the U.S.